Okay, it's kind of embarrassing how bad I am at budgeting.
Let me see your charges.
Fine.
You spent over $600 on takeout last month.
I can't cook. You know this.
Yes, I have had your disgusting food, but you're literally paying for a meal subscription on top of that.
Whoa, wait. That can't be right.
Look, just get Rocket Money. It shows you all of your expenses in one place and even tracks your subscriptions. And if there's a subscription you don't want, which for you, there are a lot you don't need, you can just cancel right in the app with a few taps.
So you mean I don't have to call anyone to cancel?
Nope. No hold times or anything. And they'll even try to get you a refund on some of the months of wasted money, which is a lot of money for you.
Okay.
And if you thought I was done, I'm not. The app can also help you make a budget that works for your income. Anytime you get close to your spending limits, it alerts you, so you know exactly where your money is going at all times.
All right, I'm in. What do I have to do?
Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple or Google Play stores.
Here with Andrew Cunningham. Andrew, here's your question for today. Supermarket Sweep is airing a very special episode. The teams are Steed and Blackbeard from Our Flag Means Death, Nick and Schmidt from New Girl, and Liz and Dud from Lodge 49. What is each team's play style and which pair wins?
Okay. All right. I've got this all gamed out.
Great.
Nick and Schmidt are beautiful idiots who implode so spectacularly that it nearly derails the game for everybody else. Schmidt's hyper-competitiveness prompts him to adopt a threatening tone toward the other contestants and the host. And Nick completely freezes whenever asked a question, remembering each answer just after the buzzer goes off and the pressure lifts. This further infuriates Schmidt, and they end up getting into a slap fight in the frozen food aisle. Steed and Blackbeard from Our Flag Means Death fare a little better. They're very excited to be there. Obviously, they vibe with each other in a way that charms the viewer and the host.
Yeah.
But they turn out to be very bad at the actual game.
Right.
As a member of the landed gentry and an 18th century man, Steed has never done any of his own grocery shopping. And as one of history's most notorious pirates, Blackbeard has stolen everything and doesn't know what anything costs. Blackbeard also is terrible at putting together the clues for the super sweep because they remind him too much of treasure maps and he won't take them seriously. Which leaves Liz and Dud. They have a weird vibe, and the announcer refers to them once as husband and wife, a thing that I have actually heard happen on real Supermarket Sweep to actual sibling teams.
Yep. So,
and you would think that Dud's snake-bitten foot would slow them down, but a lifetime of living near or under the poverty line, Dud's ability to relax and go with the flow, and Liz's single-minded focus give them the knowledge and the skills to make it through. So it's Liz and Dud. I've got it. I think so.
You fucking nailed it.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah.
Got to agree.
We're now here with Robert Bobby Krutt. And Bobby, here's your question. As you well know, as a fan, both Twin Peaks and Northern Exposure actually shot in Washington State. So what if an actor accidentally found themselves on the wrong set, but committed to make it work? Insert one character from Twin Peaks into Northern Exposure and vice versa. Who do you choose? How does it go?
Bobby, I got just some further information for you before you continue.
Oh, sure. Mm-hmm.
This is the water. This is the well.
I was refraining from bringing that up. I was so relieved that somebody else did that episode because that was always my secret. Like, I'm going to spring that on them sometime. And then once I listened to it, I thought, thank God somebody else did it.
All right. So we're swapping.
So, yeah, no, I love this question because those are two of my favorite shows. And they did, like you said, film very close to each other. And I think there's a lot of switches would make perfect sense on those. So my character from Northern Exposure to Twin Peaks, I would love to see. Well, let me skip back a second here. As you might know from Twin Peaks, Dale Cooper would record messages for his assistant, Diane, that would be sent. And we never see Diane, at least not until the third, recent season. But back then when they were filming, what I would love to see happen is for Marilyn from Northern Exposure actually play the part of Diane because, she would just sit and listen to everything quietly. Nothing would faze her. She would just say, okay, you were in a room where people were speaking backwards. Great. Next. It would just be very an ideal situation. So I would love to see that. And then the character from Twin Peaks onto Northern Exposure, I feel like so many of these would work, but I kept going back to the log lady going to Northern Exposure to be Ruth Ann, the shopkeeper's long-lost sister.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. Ruth Ann was an atheist, pragmatist, and the Log Lady is speaking to other worlds, and I think it would be a perfect sort of odd couple pairing to bring them together. So those are my flips on both of those.
I love it. Dave, did you have something to add?
I sure do. I got a straight swap. I got a straight swap for you. So on Northern Exposure, we're hearing the music, and there's a frog bug walking down the town. And then on Twin Peaks, a moose goes up the girl's mouth at the end of that episode we watched.
I'm good with all of it.
We're here with Brandy Brown. Brandy, you're a noted fan of Drive to Survive and of Formula One racing generally. You're also a fan of Dairy Girls, so that is what your question is about today. Which of the Dairy Girls do you think would be best suited to embark upon a career as a racing driver, and why? Which would be the biggest disaster? And I will add, for the purposes of this thought experiment, of course, James is a Dairy Girl, but you can also include Sister Michael if you wish.
I mean, I thought through this whole cast. Like, I have broken it all down. First of all, I think Sister Michael is your Lewis Hamilton, the best driver. There are some things I saw in season 3. I won't spoil it, but Sister Michael, without hesitation, is the best pure driver.
Okay.
Now, the next best driver, it could go either way, but I think they are a very reckless driver, but I think that they have, like, the lack of fear it would take would be Orla.
Okay.
I would put Orla on a team. There might be some crashes, but Orla has, like, that adrenaline rush. Mm-hmm. I think Orla would be great.
Yep.
I think Claire would not even get out of the pit. Claire would just lose it and just be like, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. Like, too much speed. Like, Claire would just, like, pull over to the side. You can't even pull over to the side.
Mm-hmm.
You just pull over to the side and just cry. I love Claire, but not for F1. Aaron would own an F1 team. I think Aaron would overanalyze it and the team would be garbage, but she would probably be a good, like, team principal and like hiring all the people. But again, not good. Jenny Joyce's team would definitely destroy her team. James would be in the pit crew, but he would be in definitely those highlight reels where it's like, oh no, they accidentally ran over, like, because like they didn't stop with the jack, and they, like, he'd be fine, but he would definitely be like getting his foot run over, and he'd be like, come on guys, oh come on. I think that Granda would be like so good. He would have been like the old school, like, you know, like Michael Schumacher. He would have been in the old school racer, so he would be very, very good. But I think Jerry would be the actual best principal. He would actually put together a very calm team, and also just the way that he's always muttering under his breath is what you want. If you listen to Drive to Survive, you want him to be like, box, box. Like, all right, pull over. You're doing great. Just pull into the box.
Mm-hmm.
Also, I think that who is the sister? Orla's mom, I forgot. Orla's mom would just be great in just the general culture of F1, because she's just there for a good time. She wants to meet the handsome men.
Mm-hmm.
And she's like, oh, yeah, this would be nice. And, you know, Aaron's mom would just be like, whatever, I'm not going to. She would not be involved in it, but she would support everyone. So I think that that's the breakdown, I think, of Dairy Girls. I think that's pretty much covering everyone.
Fantastic. We're here with Dr. Dan Cassino with this mind-bending question. Dan, you've been falsely accused and charged with murder. Which of your favorite old-timey crime solvers do you ask to help prove your innocence, and why? This is a two-parter. I'll just give you part one now.
All right. So if I had been actually murdered, I would want my killer to be just hassled and annoyed as much as possible by the detective before they were caught. So I'd want some of that, you know, Poirot/Columbo energy where they're just going to wish they were dead before they actually get caught. But since I'm still alive and I've been framed, I have to actually interact with this person. And
yeah.
I don't want to prefer that I would have gone to the chair instead. So I want someone who's going to solve the mystery and be likable.
Yep.
So I'm going to go with young Endeavor Morse, right?
Mm.
So he's solving murders in Oxford. So I get to hang out in Oxford. He's used to solving a bunch of cases involving academics, right?
Yep.
So I'm going to be right at home. One downside, I do have a lot of Masons in my family, and he really hates Masons. But I think I think we can turn him and, you know, so he'll actually solve the case for me.
All right. Here's part two. Once Morris has gotten you off on the charges, once that's done, which Taskmaster contestant do you enlist to plot the most elaborate and punitive vengeance on the person who tried to frame you?
See, I think this part's a lot easier because there's one Taskmaster contestant who's really shown ability to plot things out better than anyone else.
Yep.
And change the game. And that's Richard Osman from series two, mm-hmm. right? So he solved tasks in a way that no one else had anticipated, forced the producers to change the way that they write all of the tasks.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So he couldn't do that. And maybe more important for this, he's the author of a best-selling series of these clockwork murder mysteries set in a British retirement community,
right.
Which is the most British thing ever, but they're really good books and bestsellers. And I've read all of them, of course, because I am an 83-year-old woman. And so he can plot a crime perfectly. And those books always end with the retirees getting away with some serious crime and framing someone else for it. So we can definitely do this. And also, perhaps more importantly, I actually do want to come back from this adventure in England with my wife. Mm-hmm. And if we were just there with Morse, that could be a problem. So because basically, I'm not sure she'd want to come home with me after hanging out with Morse so much.
Totally.
So basically, I think Richard Osman is going to level that out because he is not a conventionally attractive gentleman. Mm. I'm not saying he couldn't do TV in the United States. I'm saying in the US, we probably wouldn't let him even watch TV. So that's going to be a big plus here.
Thank you, Dan. Dan Rogge, my question for you. Elizabeth Holmes of The Dropout and Deborah Vance of Hacks are trading lives for 6 months. How does Elizabeth do hawking her own signature fashion and home goods line on QVC? And is Deborah able to turn things around at Theranos?
So first of all, not only do I find this a fascinating prompt, it's also a pretty sturdy pitch for an 80-body comedy swap that Deborah Vance herself would have appeared in
yes?
as like Fred Savage's mom for some reason. So following the Holmes-Vance switcheroo, which I assume to have been the result of a put-upon TV writer smashing an enchanted Roku box following the cancellation of yet another one of his streaming series just as season three starts airing, Deborah and Elizabeth wake up in each other's bodies for a six-month stint. First question being, which 6 months? So, the answer lies in how we know things ended for them, since in their most recent journeys, they each had a respective and very specific goal to meet. One of them succeeded, and one of them failed. Is it because Holmes's goals of remaking all biomedical engineering as we know it were loftier than Vance's goal of becoming a more immortal Elaine Boozler? Fuck no. And Deborah will put her one drop of blood, sweat, and tears through comedy's Edison spinny spinny machine to triumph in anybody she has the misfortune to quantum leap into. So, on a tour bus just outside of Tulsa somewhere, Elizabeth wakes up as Deborah and thinks, wow, now I'm just a hack. How hard can this really be? But if there's one thing we've learned from the scant info we have about Elizabeth Holmes, just the book, the podcast, the other podcast, the documentary, the podcast, the set of commemorative dinner plates, the podcast, and The Dropout, it's that Elizabeth Holmes gets a B- in scamming and an F- in time management. I am firmly in the camp of people who thinks that she thought that the technology was just going to catch up with her good idea one day. She's not like, sorry, this is a total side, but she's not like the WeWorks guy because
right.
I literally watched one episode of that show. Jared Leto's entire grift was seeing people think his stupid idea in real time and being like, you wouldn't like it. Communal workstations are really more of a Shelbyville idea. And then everyone was like, Whereas Elizabeth was like, I've got the turtleneck, you've got the tech, I will see you in 5 years, chemists. And so we know that Holmes can technically sell anything to any old white Joe Bidens she runs into, but mm-hmm. she has an entire comedy set to finish by the time she gets to Vegas. So the curtain opens at the Palmetto, and there's one low-energy joke about Sonny pissing her off, so she heads his so she sets his house on fire. The end. For Holmes, there's going to be more blood drawn in the reviews than there ever was at Walgreens. Am I right? Deborah, meanwhile, wakes up as Elizabeth and thinks, wow, now this is what being a hack feels like. How hard can this really be? One gal's Palmetto is another gal's Walgreens after all, so looking at herself in the mirror as Elizabeth and barking once, if you want to con men, try doing it in a dress, to her turtleneck reflection, and then without missing a beat, Deborah strips all of Theranos for parts, keeping only the name and gifting the trademark to DJ for her 40th birthday, using the technology to refurbish the machinery into a jewelry manufacturer for DJ's de jewelry line, Deborah promising on QVC that one spin of that jewelry in the Edison machine prevents the bracelets from turning your arm black, a promise she delivers on and turns a $1 billion profit for Theranos Jewelry from their first product that actually works. Sure, it's easy to put them on even playing fields as problematic female heroes, but the real juxtaposition of a grating, misguided, quote, girl, quote, boss, who alienates everyone she meets by thinking that she's smarter than everyone else in the room, that's for the sequel, when Elizabeth switches bodies with Ava. Come over!
We're here with Danny, Daniel McEachern. And here is your thought experiment, Danny. Oh, no! Abbott Elementary's Ava Coleman has talked herself into another job she's not qualified for. She's the new manager at the original Beef of Chicagoland, as seen in The Bear. How does it go? And please, we're going to just tell our listeners, there will be spoilers for the end of The Bear, so be aware. Proceed.
All right, well, Ava shows up because she's a distant cousin of Marcus's. Mm-hmm. He doesn't know her because the family connection is somewhat broken by divorces and remarriages, family disputes, that sort of thing.
Sure.
The only person who has any idea who Ava is Pete, because he subscribes to all her social media channels, and he vouches for her. Ava explains to the audience that she's there because she got wind of all the money that Carmi found, and her cash dar let her down I-76 from Philadelphia to Chicago. Now, The Bear isn't going to become like The Office and Parks and Rec, but Ava is going to maintain that aspect from Abbott Elementary. She's going to be the only one on the show who talks to the camera. Mm-hmm. Now, she immediately hits it off with Richie, who loves her outspokenness, especially the way she irks Carmi, who is envisioning a much more refined kind of customer than he thinks Ava will be targeting. And Richie especially loves the way Ava gets up the nose of Sydney, who is definitely the Janine of The Bear. Mm-hmm. So the tensions simmer and flare up just like restaurant kitchens do and shows mm-hmm. about restaurants do. Mm-hmm. But everybody comes to grudgingly respect Ava and the perspective she brings, especially when a TikTok she posts in the season finale goes viral, making The Bear Chicago's most talked about new restaurant. But it's in the season's touching penultimate episode that Ava and Carmi bond when he learns that Ava's personality is something of a mask that she puts on to avoid discussing her own personal problems. And that's when we learn that Ava left Philadelphia not to get a share of the money, but because the grandmother she was caring for, the main reason Ava, as principal, rolled in at 9 and rolled out at 3, has died. And Ava decided in her grief that the best thing for her was a new start in a new city. And that episode closes with Ava going to sleep happy, finally feeling at home in her new surroundings, and the camera pulls out, lingering on the framed picture of her and Gritty she has on her nightstand.
Yeah, you nailed it.
Yeah, that was great. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Gorgeous.
The only question is, what does she bring for a family meal?
Right. We're here with Dave Chen. Dave, my question for you is this. Succession's Shiv Roy has decided that Waystar is not for her and is going back into politics to run a comeback campaign for Veep's Selena Meyer. How does Shiv fit in with Selena's staff? What's her chemistry with Selena herself? How does Shiv's siblings insert themselves to make her job harder? And does Selena win? What are your thoughts?
Well, my first thought is whoever came up with this question is a genius.
That's me. Thank you.
It was you. Well, anyway, Shiv, I think, would fit in perfectly with Selena Meyer because Shiv's whole thing on Succession is that she, like, cuts people down in extremely subtle ways. Like, 80% of Shiv's lines are insults.
Yeah.
And that would fit in extremely well with Selena's staff, which, like, spends all their time cutting each other down,
yep.
deploying bon mots and all this stuff like that. So, in fact, I would argue that Shiv would have had a more successful career as part of Selena's team than she had on than the short-lived stint she had on Gil Evis's team, in which she was basically fired because of a sort of insensitive remark that she made. Obviously, they talk like that, you know, in the first 5 minutes of the day at the Selena's office. Then they do, you know, like that was presented as like, oh, wow, well, the lowest of the low with Gil Evis on the Succession season 2. But in this show, that would have happened in the first 5 minutes of the first episode. So
for sure.
I think she would have done really well and had great, great chemistry with the rest of the staff. She would have fit right in. As for Selena herself, I think it's a mixed bag. I think Selena would like the fact that Shiv is a killer, but would eventually be threatened by her ambition and would then do things to try to take her down. So she'd probably be slightly more successful than Anna Chlumsky was on that show, who I think Selena never really respected until, you know, towards the end of that show. But I think she would have respected Shiv because Shiv comes from money and power and has a killer instinct. As for Shiv's siblings, they would drive a lot of coverage right. of Selena's mishaps and make a meal out of it. But ultimately, I think Selena would actually get along with them because I think she would want to use their resources for her own ends. So I think she'd find a way to grin and bear these extremely sort of incompetent and in some ways terrible people.
Yeah, the interaction I most want to see, I have to say now that I've said it, is Connor and Jonah. Bouncing off each other, the two biggest idiots on each show, but proceed.
I think a Roman Selena interaction would also be very funny as well.
Yeah.
I could see that being very amusing. Does Selena win? Unfortunately, no, because despite everything I have just said, Shiv is fundamentally incompetent. And the seasons two of three of Succession reveal that she is just not very good, unfortunately, which is a shame because I was rooting for that character from the start. And ended up not paying off. So no, she does not win. Shiv is not good at her job.
But she still gets paid, and that's all that counts.
Yes, indeed.
We're here with Devinder Hardwar. Devinder, my question for you today is as follows. Los Espookies is, unfortunately, still a pretty under-the-radar show, but maybe that could change with a splashy event in season three, specifically... We're going to cross over Los Espookies and the X-Files. How do Mulder and Scully cross paths with Rinaldo, Tati, Ursula, and Andres? And what happens?
So, Mulder and Scully hear stories of an unusual being in Mexico, one who can speak to spirits, potentially see through space and time, and whose logic defies human understanding. Of course, they're looking for Tati, who they discover may or may not be a creature from outer space, or her perhaps beyond our plane of existence. In this multi-episode arc, Mulder slowly falls in love with Tati and decides to retire to Mexico, where he can chump on sunflower seeds all day, watch porn, and explore the endless mystery of Tati. Scully finds kinship in the more practical Ursula, and they ultimately bond over a shared love and exasperation around Mulder and Tati.
That's
it's a good arc.
Brilliantly perfect. Believable.
Oh my God.
Perfect.
Make it happen. We're here with Elon Muscat. Here is your question. Jane Krakowski has been a mainstay of Tina Fey sitcoms and yet has not been in the one that is actually all about female singers, which she is. So my challenge to you is write her into season three of Girls 5 Eva. Who is she? What is her function on the show?
Okay. So if Jane Krakowski is going to make an entrance onto Girls 5 Eva, there's really only one figure in the sort of 90s pop music world that she could be an analog for. And that is, of course, Britney and this sort of seismic impact on the pop world that Britney made. Now, the challenge is going to be threading that needle where she's not wandering into all the sort of darkness that Britney has had to go through for whoever's fault that is. So you have this figure who resurfaces, but what she's been doing is maybe where she's been hasn't been the subject of all the coverage. So rather than publicly melting down, maybe she vanishes and she comes back and suddenly she's back on the scene and wanting to, you know, Sandman style, reclaim her throne. So she, you know, she's got her comeback machinations, and the Girls 5 Eva group are trying to emerge from her shadow as she suddenly sucks up all the oxygen and becomes this figure. But who knows how that time has changed her, and who knows what her new priorities are. So there could be all sorts of weirdness that that the Jane Krakowski character starts to introduce messaging into her music, and really thinking of it almost like Soldier Boy on The Boys. Figure from the past had a sort of a public disappearance from the productive scene, comes back. So what we've got is this arc, and there's probably a sort of a musical thing. Do they collaborate with her? Do they trust her? And in the end game, is she going to have to go back in the box, or is she going to emerge?
If you want to marry it with something else that's happening in sort of the present day, I feel like her comeback is tied into her idea for an analog for the Goop Lab. And that her new comeback is sort of like a veiled promotion for all things, you know, wellness. Jade Vagina Stone.
Jade, yeah.
Yeah, I love it. We're here with Jeff Drake, the world's number one fan of the NBC sci-fi drama La Brea. He is also secondarily a fan of Disney Plus's recent TV series offerings, or at least, you know, he's watched them. So I'm asking Jeff, which titular character is going to fare the best after they fall into La Brea's sinkhole, and why? Your options are Moon Knight, Obi-Wan Kenobi, Ms. Marvel, and She-Hulk.
First of all, let's say that it's a tough fate for anybody to fall down the La Brea hole.
It's not good.
It is. You've gone somewhere. Nobody knows where it is, but apparently I have found out through talking to people about this that when this show was pitched, the creator of this show had like 12 seasons gamed out.
Oh, no.
Like, this is where it goes. No. Sinkhole's opening up. Yeah.
He's been working on this since he was 11. He's got sketches from his schools with pterodactyls with like the wrong number of wings and everything.
Yeah. I don't know if you remember a terrible NBC show called Surface.
Sure.
Where there was something under the surface and it had the famous line in it where there was a guy who kept going, they found a submarine and on it, it had bite marks.
Yeah.
That was in like every promo. Anyway, so that's what it reminded me of. Because those guys apparently put on a big show. But then afterwards, somebody in the room was like, they might have been coked up. Anyway, so falling down the La Brea hole, you've got all of these characters. I'm gonna go worst to who does worst to best.
Please.
And so first of all, I'd say Obi-Wan fares the worst. Mm. This iteration of Obi-Wan is boring and passive, and he hardly uses his powers. And when he does, it's like he feels bad that he did it. And he's just kind of a bummer. And so like everybody would be like, well, I mean, you say that you got these powers, so like you could help us maybe. And he's like, but a Jedi Knight only does it. And they're like, enough with the Jedi Knight. Jesus. Yeah. All I hear about is what Jedi Knights can't do. Mm-hmm. Apparently, Jedi Knights can't get us out of the La Brea hole. Move on, Obi-Wan.
Are you a Jedi Can Knight or a Jedi Can't Knight?
Exactly. Anyway, next up would be Moon Knight. Okay, I don't know. Maybe he'd be okay down there. Mm-hmm. It's maybe not. It's hard to say. What even happened on that show? Exactly.
I don't know.
I feel like I liked parts of it, and other parts I was like, oh, okay. Oh, now it's getting going. Oh, it's over. Okay. So I just think it would be way too confusing. Which one is he? Turns out now there's three of them. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah. You guys, you were already a lot down in this hole as one guy. So we're moving on to the next one. Then I'd go Ms. Marvel. She's cool. Mm. She's together. She's got cool powers. She's entertaining. I'd be sad that her parents weren't down there because I want those parents to be my parents or at least to replace my dad who was terrible. So is that too much to share?
No.
Do you want to? Are we able to still send it to your dad? Can we do that?
If you find a way, please do.
Damn.
Yeah.
Got him.
So that leaves.
No. That leaves. She-Hulk.
She-Hulk.
So the She-Hulk, she would be the most useful. She's a lawyer, mind of a lawyer, body of a Hulk.
Wait, how's a lawyer going to help down in the La Brea pit?
Just with the thing. Also, she's sassy and charismatic.
Is she going to sue the dinosaurs?
Look, she is a sassy, charismatic lady. She's got hoobs.
Yeah,
she's I'm sorry. That's a throwback to another podcast. But anyway, that's a tie back in. Mm-hmm. The majority of the whole people are just not all that charismatic. And so she'd be like she's a breath of fresh air down there. She's green. She sticks out. But like everybody be like, I want to hang out with She-Hulk. And so I think she's the winner of this. And even just after one kind of shaky episode.
You did it.
That might have been my favorite answer.
Anyway, thank you, Jeff.
Sure. Thanks for having me. It was a delight. Glad to see everybody else is getting old, too.
We're here with Joe Reed. Joe, here is your question for today. Wiki Roy of Girls 5 Eva is the subject of a scripted true crime series in the style of The Staircase. What did she do? When did she do it? Which is to say, was it between the band's early aughts heyday and now, or something you imagine she might do in the future? And what even more outlandish star is playing her?
All right, so this television series got titled The Futon. It is a 10-part limited series about the time that a post-fame, pre-revival Wiki Roy was crashing on Diddy's couch during the taping of a season of Making the Band. She befriended the younger hopefuls, partied with them, and then one morning, one of them was found dead inside a folded-up sofa bed. Suspicion fell on Wiki, but no solid proof was ever found, despite suspicious feathers found at the scene, which were later discovered to be endangered osprey feathers from the boa she stole from Ashley Simpson's house. Still, rumors persisted that Wiki had taken on a Ma-like presence within the group, so obviously Wiki will be played by Octavia Spencer in the role of a lifetime.
Oh my god, no notes, perfect. We're here with John Ramos. John, here's your question for today. They have not discussed it yet, but the vampire housemates of What We Do in the Shadows first arrived in New York in 1882, for the sake of this thought experiment, the very same year as the Gilded Age's first season. So the four of them, no Guillermo yet, sorry, end up meeting Marion Brooke, Ada Brooke, and Agnes Van Ryn at one of Bertha Russell's balls. How does that go?
Well, while the vampires have varying degrees of gentility, their accents blind the Gilded Age principals into thinking they are high society folk in much the same way Laszlo's toothpick and blue jeans made him appear to everyone else as a regular human bartender. Thus accepted, they are invited to a party where three vamps each gravitate toward a member of the Brooke family. Nadja, intrigued by Marion's proto-progressivism, turns her into a vampire sidekick, and the two of them take twisted but satisfying revenge on the trifling Mr. Rakes. Nandor pays off with Ada. While he originally intends to feed on her, she places him as a vampire, does not judge him as such, but recognizes his underlying tenderness. While Nandor is drawn to her emotional intelligence, and the two of them start night dating. But how, you ask, did Ava place him as a vampire? Well, then Laszlo seduces Agnes into a dance. He leans in and bites her neck. A close-up shows him looking confused, and the camera pans around to reveal Agnes is likewise trying to bite him. She is a vampire herself. The two share their vampiric history, setting up both series up for future crossover events. Will Laszlo be lured away from Nadja permanently by Agnes's mix of sophistication and practicality? No spoilers, but he does love the way when she transforms, she regally verbalizes, bat.
I'm sorry, the correct answer is they find out Marion is also an energy vampire because she's so boring.
That's so, that's so much better, God.
She's so boring.
We're here with Karina Longworth. Karina, here is our question for you today. Alicia Florek of The Good Wife clearly needs a new spouse for reasons both in her reality and in our reality. Which of Mad Men's Sterling Cooper or Sterling Cooper Draper Price staffers is Alicia's best match and why? Note that the ladies are also totally up for grabs. It's 2022.
Yeah, but I feel like Alicia's pretty heteronormative, so I really only considered men. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think that one of the great things about The Good Wife is the way in which by the end of the series, you get this sense that she has been transformed by her environment and that power completely corrupts. And that, so as much as, you know, you might lament the loss of Will Gardner, as much as like it was sexy to see her with Jason, the investigator, I think that she does need like somebody corrupt to partner with, mm-hmm. like in order to actually like get shit done. And so while I think that she could have a hot affair with Don Draper, I think that probably like the power couple situation is her and Harry Crane.
Oh, wow. I wouldn't have gone. I thought you were going to say Pete. And I was like, but you're totally right.
I thought you were going to say Roger. So yeah, I love that pick. That's so unexpected.
Wait, but Harry Crane is the guy that goes into television early, right?
Yeah.
So that is very much in sync with like going to where the future power lies. Mm-hmm, so it makes total
sure.
sense. Yeah.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Brilliant.
Yep.
Perfectly.
Good choice.
Perfectly answered. Thank you. All right. We're here with Kim Reed. Kim, here's your question for today. Julie Stouffer has most recently been seen showing her ass and reportedly a lot more of her husband's anatomy in the Real World Homecoming New Orleans to pretty much universal condemnation. So it's a good thing you have the power to insert her into a past season of Survivor with the stipulation that there's no way she could possibly win. Which season would you pick and why?
Okay, well, the for the lulz answer is Survivor Fiji, which is famously the divided by race slash ethnicity. Put her on, you know, the black tribe and watch them murder her quickly. Because I was thinking like, okay, do I want her to suffer or do I want her to leave early? And I think the answer is I want her to leave early. I think anyone who goes on Survivor probably suffers because then she's on my TV less. Plus, I know from Julie's time on the challenge that she hates losing. So getting voted out early would also cause her to suffer. So win-win. In that vein, I would put her on the Oolong tribe from Survivor Panama, which was the 10th season, often referred to as the worst tribe of all time. They had 9 people on the tribe. They lost the first 8 immunity challenges. The only reason the other tribe had to go to a tribal council was because they did one of those things where both tribes go to tribal council, no matter who wins. So they got down to 1 person, Stephanie LaGrossa. She ended up getting consumed, I don't know, subsumed, I'm not sure what word you would use, by the other tribe and ended up getting voted out 7th. So even if Julie somehow got into the Stephanie LaGrossa slot, the best she would do would be 7th. But it was hilarious to watch the Oolong tribe, which was physically dominant over the other tribe. The other tribe had a couple of older people, some not as strong, not as big people, but the Oolong tribe was just a mess and they just could not get it together. And they lost every single immunity challenge that they participated in. So that tribe on Survivor Panama is where I would place Julie Stouffer. Thank you.
Fantastic. We're here with Nadia Choudhury. Nadia, here is your guest thought experiment. Obi-Wan Kenobi has decided to take a sabbatical, so Cassie Bowden of The Flight Attendant is stepping in to cover his shift. Describe how well or badly she manages his main tasks, which, as we all know, are looking after a slippery 10-year-old princess, sneaking on and off various modes of transportation, lightsaber fighting a former protege who's now a galactic villain, and filleting a very large mantle. Go.
Okay, so granted, I haven't finished this latest season of The Flight Attendant, but I honestly believe the banter between Cassie and Leia would be the most amazing banter ever in existence. I think they would butt heads. I think they would make each other become aware of self-insecurities and self-stories about themselves. And even though they would both cause a lot of mayhem, both Cassie probably ditching Leia at points and Leia running away from Cassie at points, they would ultimately be successful in whatever missions that they are in charge of. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Fantastic.
And I think specifically in terms of Cassie dealing with fighting her protege turned villain, I mean, that's essentially what she's been doing. I think she would suck at it. I think she would start crying. But then ultimately the villain would say something so hurtful that Cassie would just run and stab them over and over again and then be surprised that she won.
Anything about the large mammal or transportation, we could just...
I think she wouldn't even bother doing it or make Leia do it, honestly. And Leia would do it happily, probably.
I'm here with Nick Reinwald-Jones. And Nick, here is your question for today. Buffy Summers, Sydney Bristow, and Daenerys Targaryen find themselves in the Thunderdome. Who does what and who ends up covered in the blood of her foes? Note, Elizabeth Jennings was also originally part of this battle royale because Nick also knows the Americans very well. But then I remembered she was already in the TV Mom Thunderdome, so I decided to leave her out of this battle. Nick, tell us how it goes down.
All right. Well, first of all, the other three are definitely lucky that Elizabeth Jennings is not involved because they would have all been dead before they even got into the Thunderdome.
That's right.
And she would have had sex with all their husbands, whether or not they had been. So I feel like an important thing about setting Thunderdome situations is the ground rules. you know, I don't think it's fair to allow Dany to have a dragon in there because that would just, you know, the dragon would just kill everyone. Mm-hmm. But then again, without the dragon, what can Dany really do except like seduce people and show her boobs?
Sure.
So
As the, you know, the liaison between us and the Thunderdome committee, just a couple points to back you up. First of all, maybe you can cram a dragon in the Thunderdome with no room for anything else, but there is an entrance to the Thunderdome and it is person sized. So the dragon actually would not be able to get into the...
And it is domed. It doesn't have a...
That's right.
It doesn't have an open roof.
Maybe the dome has been the dragon the whole time.
Well, I was going to say,
think of that.
You start with the dragon egg and you build the dome over it and then just wait for it to grow.
I think we would have noticed the dragon.
We might.
Around it. This is not a bottle of booze with a pear in it.
It's the elephant in the room. Nobody talk about the dragon, guys.
All right, Nick, proceed.
So, you know, but Dany is pretty smart and she would want to have some kind of, you know, way of making sure that she doesn't just end up easily dead, which, you know, she's not a fighter. So I feel like Dany would probably, she's a decent negotiator though. So I think she would probably negotiate some kind of, you know, I'll accept like last place or something and you guys will get, you know, some gold or whatever. Like, cause you know, that's how it always went with her, where she was able to sort of convince people to, you know, not kill her for various reasons, you know, especially if it was later in the series and she had Tyrion with her, because, you know, obviously he could do that kind of thing too. In your week to week Buffy battles, you know, she was usually pretty good at, you know, killing your average vampire or demon or whatever. But when it came to like the big bads, those were inevitably the ones where Buffy's getting her ass kicked and then someone else like jumps in to save her, whether it's Giles or Willow, you know, probably not Xander because he's tripping on his dick, but whatever.
Sure.
So
accurate.
So in terms of like the, yeah, like in terms of having like a matchup where she's really, you know, well matched. Yeah. I think she'd probably not have the upper hand there. And then Sydney was, you know, usually required to really, you know, think fast because she would have this whole thing planned out in advance. It would all go tits up and then she'd have to, you know, pull something out at the very end and, you know, kill someone cleverly or, I mean, not really kill because it was ABC, but like, you know, maim them. So at that point, I think, yeah, it would be pretty close. You know, Buffy would definitely put up a fight, but also, you know, Buffy is not, Buffy has like one weapon. It's a piece of wood. So, you know, what are you really going to do with that? And, you know, Sydney knows how to use everything. So I think it would be pretty drawn out, a little bit like the amazing end of season two fight between Sydney and fake Francie. There would be a lot of throwing around because they both have great stunt doubles. A lot of heads getting bashed. A lot of
point
people
of
getting
order.
Up from
Thunderdome
things.
Is real. There are no stunt doubles in Thunderdome.
A lot of people getting up from things that they shouldn't be able to get up from.
Yes.
Okay, well, let me check with the Thunderdome liaison on this
I'm
as
here.
Well.
Present.
So does the Thunderdome, is it just a completely bare facility, or does it have things that you might be able to like improvise weapons with?
Nick, excellent question. There are implements of death, analog instruments of death, swords, cudgels, maces, that kind of thing.
Oh, okay.
Here and there for the people to grab off, usually in the upper tiers. If you remember Thunderdome, sometimes they usually start in jolly jumpers. Remember? The big sort of bungee cordy things, which are usually chopped off pretty quickly as these fights go. We haven't really talked a lot about the bungee cords because we can barely get Sarah in for these episodes to start with, and I don't want to introduce bungee cords. So, yes, there are weapons available.
Why am I the enemy of fun?
I don't know. I need
you're the one
for that
who's
sentence.
Like, well, if we're talking about cartoons and dead people, point of order. Like,
are there raisins in the Thunderdome?
Yeah. Seriously. The problem with the Thunderdome is not the Thunderdome. It's Dave. Anyway, back to you, Nick.
Look. You're not wrong, but it's why it works.
This is Nick's moment.
So there might be, so in that case, there might be some, because, you know, of all her Giles training and stuff, there might be some things that Buffy could actually make use of other than her standard stick. So I mean, Sydney would take some cuts for sure, but Sydney, you know, has been known to, you know, stab, shot, whatever, and keep going.
Yep.
You know, who knows what she hid in her wig.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, that was another thing I was going to mention. Sydney would immediately because of being a wig expert, Sydney would immediately recognize the fakeness of Danny's wig. Yeah. And Danny would be morally destroyed from that right from the get-go. But yeah, so I think it would ultimately end in a Sydney victory, although Sydney would probably, it would be a season finale and Sydney would need a couple months to recuperate in a hospital while we wondered if she was, going to make it or not. But then, right. Vaughn shows up and kisses her and she's fine. So,
yeah. Perfect ending. We're here with Roxana Hadadi. Roxana, here is your question. Please ponder it and tell us your answer. You have written about a couple of shows with notably bad, occasionally scary bosses. Would you prefer to be managed by Abbott Elementary's Ava or Severance's Harmony Cobell, and why? And I have a follow-up, but you can start with that.
I think that I would probably want to be managed by Ava because her mismanagement doesn't necessarily put my life at risk.
Right.
It just potentially gives me like fewer school supplies.
Right, right.
rather than like invasive brain surgery and then stalking me in my home and potentially pulling me into a strange cult. Mm-hmm. So I'll go with Ava because she's like fun chaotic rather than destructive chaotic.
She also seems like she wouldn't really be that hands-on. Like she doesn't really care what you do as long as you're not in her business.
Right. I just see her like in the break room and she'd say something mean about my outfit and like, I'm used to that. I've lived a life with that, so I'm good.
All right. So here's the follow-up. Which of your worst TV enemies would you sentence to work for Harmony Cobell?
Oh, this is such a good question. Well, I think that probably one of my worst TV enemies is somebody also from the workplace mockumentary tradition. So I would maybe say Michael Scott.
Good choice.
Because it's so strange to me how The Office like retconned him into being a good manager.
Yeah.
We all saw him actually being extremely terrible. So I would sort of be interested if he were in a Severance situation to see how would he deal with scary numbers or like the finger trap. I don't think Michael Scott could ever get out of a finger trap. So I would be fascinated to see that.
No, I think he would have a stroke. I think you're right.
Yeah, I think that he would just collapse and he wouldn't be able to make it back into the elevator. He would just be lost to Keir forever.
Yeah.
So that's my choice.
Perfect. Santiago, I have a thought experiment for you involving two shows I know you know very well. It's a two-parter, so I'll just start with this one. Okay. Which RuPaul's Drag Race contestant do you feel would make the best U.S. president?
This is a very easy question. It is Bob the Drag Queen.
Okay,
explain. She's smart, charismatic, politically engaged, and an activist even before her Drag Race days. Perfect person. Make her president. Done.
Also electable, more so than other Drag Race success stories, I would say.
Absolutely.
Whatever that means. And of the follow-up, which character from the West Wing do you think would go the furthest on RuPaul's Drag Race?
Okay, buckle up. This one's a little more complicated.
Okay.
I knew immediately who I thought from the West Wing would win Drag Race, but that changed as I was mapping out the season in my head.
Okay.
So let me explain. Toby would be eliminated immediately in episode one.
Yes.
I don't think I need to explain why.
You don't.
President Jed Bartlett is eliminated in episode two for coming out onto the main stage wearing boat shoes for the second time in a row. There's a group acting challenge early on, but Donna does not speak up for herself, gets a lame role that she self-consciously stumbles through, and goes home.
Okay.
The next episode, Josh gets eliminated during the sewing challenge. He spent the entire work time yelling for Donna to come help him, not realizing that she already went home. He walks out onto the runway in a toga he threw on at the last second.
Yep.
CJ and Mary Louise Parker's Amy Gardner are expected to do well in the Snatch Game, but they both have an off night and have to lip sync for their lives. Production chooses The Jackal as the lip sync song, CJ lives to slay another day.
Thumb on the scale.
Mm-hmm. Charlie is eliminated in the stand-up comedy challenge for going too vulgar in front of the First Lady. Sam Seaborn does really well throughout the competition, but he's eliminated right before the finale in the music video challenge. Now, in the finale, it is a very close race between CJ and First Lady Dr. Abby Bartlett. CJ is the producer's favorite, but Abby is the whole package. Fashion, comedy, brains. She has 4 challenge wins under her belt, which, for those who don't know, is a lot. The crown is hers to lose. But just like Shea Coulee losing the crown as quickly as it takes for rose petals to flutter to the ground, one competitor swoops in at the last second in a single moment of glory and wins. Please play the clip.
Mr. Thomas?
Yes.
I'm CJ Craig. My assistant spoke to you on the phone.
Yes.
Mrs. Coatsworth, hey, I'm CJ Craig. I'm the White House press secretary. This is Will Bailey, our deputy communications director, and this is Amelia Gardner, who's the First Lady's chief of staff, and this is her first day, as a matter of fact. We're so happy that you were able to take the time to come over so we could talk this through.
I'm Marion Coatsworth, hey.
I was thinking of this thing from... this thing that just happened with the deficit.
Oh, God.
Marion Coatsworth, hey, you're a winner, baby!
Oh, I thought God, the end was going to be a face peel and a secret agent Ron Butterfield.
I thought that's where it was going to.
We're talking to Sarah Baker. Sarah, here's your question. Chicken Lady is hosting the Muppet Show. How does it go?
By the way, inspired question.
Thank you so
much. Kudos to you. So, Chicken Lady, for the woefully uninformed, please head to YouTube immediately, is from Kids in the Hall. She is, as you might have guessed, part chicken, part lady. Lady is a stretch. She is a female woman, but lady, I don't know. So, the show opens on Kermit and Scooter backstage, Scooter assuring Kermit that, yes, he took the charcuterie board they normally put in the host's dressing room and replaced it with the requested gravel and grubs. When the Chicken Lady meets Kermit, she is immediately smitten, much to the chagrin of Miss Piggy, who finds out she's being replaced by the Chicken Lady in the opening number duet with Kermit of Let's Call the Whole Thing Off. You weren't part chicken, and I am all frog. Which devolves into the Chicken Lady cornering Kermit and saying, I want to see how big it is. Kermit, in a move of self-preservation, hides the Chicken Lady with the chickens, where Camilla discovers that she and the Chicken Lady are related. In the audience, we hear Waldorf say, well, that was a moving moment. And Statler says, yeah, move it to Albuquerque. This sweet moment turns sour quickly when the Chicken Lady is introduced to Camilla's boyfriend, Gonzo, and refocuses her considerable sexual energy on him. As Camilla steps to the challenge for her man, the two trade pecks, only further riling up the Chicken Lady into a sexual frenzy. Kermit worriedly rushes the stage, saying, Gonzo, the show is bombing! At which point, resident Muppet Show pyrotechnic expert Crazy Harry rushes in, did somebody say bombing? Setting off an explosion, which triggers the Chicken Lady's own orgasmic explosion of feathers. Kermit closes the show by announcing that Crazy Harry and the Chicken Lady are engaged. Yay!
We're here with Simone Chavour and with the introduction of Power Droid Gonk into the TV canon thanks to his appearance in Obi-Wan Kenobi as the Desert Sushi Factory's time card puncher, we are now able to ask the following important TV question. If Melrose Place, the building, was repurposed for TV characters who exhibit electrical powers, how would the relationship dynamics play out among, 1, Gonk the Power Droid, 2, Uncle Fester from the Addams Family, 3, the Watchmen's Dr. Manhattan, 4, Black Lightning, and 5, Throg, that's Frog 4, as seen in a Loki Easter egg. You put them all in Melrose Place, what's going to happen? Simone, please give us your thoughts.
Okay, so looking at this cast of characters, you know, they are really pretty different, even though they have that unifying, like, superpower or connection, electrical connection, if
the
you will.
The spark between them.
Yeah, and so I'm thinking Gonk. Gonk is like the cat that wanders around the building. Everyone knows it. Everyone loves it. You like to stop and pet it. Who's a gonk? Who's a good little gonk? But secretly, Gonk has been playing everybody because everybody's feeding Gonk. And no one knows that everyone else is feeding Gonk. So Gonk is like really like this mastermind behind, you know, living in this little community. Everyone thinks he's simple and cute, but no, he's like making out like a bandit. Uncle Fester is, you know, it's you go to open mic, there's a guy who's marginally talented, can just maybe do Wonderwall, but he's so nice and so fun in the crowd that you're like, yeah, we could tolerate him. He can just do a light bulb in his mouth, that's about it, but he's also really nice and he buys our drinks. Dr. Manhattan is that weirdo with, you know, he's got the foil up in the windows of his apartment, doesn't really answer the door, is spotted only like in brief glimpses as he's walking from his car to his door and does not make eye contact.
But just to be sure, just to be clear, in this universe, Dr. Manhattan needs a car.
Yeah.
Okay, good.
Yes.
I love it. This is my favorite part of the answer so far. Dr. Manhattan needs a car. All right, continue.
He drives. No, he wouldn't do a Tesla.
It's an Acura. We all know it's an Acura.
He's going to do a Prius.
Oh, okay.
Prius.
Nice.
Oh, yeah. Well, that makes sense.
But like when you do run into him in the hall, like he's got this, you know, vibe about him that he's got a lot of things on his mind. You know, maybe he took that Prius to Mars to like contemplate humanity and then came on back to his apartment in the complex for some reason.
Yeah.
Instead of building his palace on Mars. So, you know, kind of creepy, but like just in a way that you kind of give him some space, but you're not like actively like calling the building manager, like saying that he's hanging out, you know, in the courtyard for too long. Now, Black Lightning, I actually am not that familiar with. I watched the trailer for the show to kind of get a vibe. And seems like the cool dude that everyone knows and always has like a tool that you can borrow. So if you need like a little drill or you need like a little handsaw or, you know, a cup of sugar, like he's nice. He seems, you know, helpful and friendly. Everyone feels comfortable like knocking on the door and just having a quick little chat before you ask him to borrow something. Mm-hmm. But you do remember to bring it back. You're not going to mess with him that way. You will bring it back. And then finally, Throg, the Frog Thor, I think is kind of that unexpectedly smart person. They kind of scattered, kind of, you know, you can clearly see that they've left their keys in the front door and have just forgotten and walked away.
Oh, that's you, Dave.
It's also, it's me. It's Walter Bishop.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's me.
But when you start talking to him, you know that like there's something more there, something more under that froggy, glistening amphibian exterior. So a good one to know. But sometimes you do have to remember to like take his mail in for him.
Perfect answer. No notes.
Great. Yeah.
We're here with Stephanie Early Green. Stephanie, I crafted a brain teaser for you based on what I know you know in the TV realm, and it is as follows. I'm challenging you to take Tim and Sam of Detroiters, assign one of them to the Bachelor on the next season, and the other to be a contestant on The Bachelorette. Please tell us who you're sending where and why, what your rationale was for where you're sending them, and how far does your Bachelorette contestant get in the process?
Okay, well, this honestly could go either way, and I was sort of on the fence.
Yep.
But I think you'd all agree with me that Tim is the more obviously socially maladjusted of the two.
Yes.
So that means realistically, ABC would immediately cast him as The Bachelor. because ABC has a long and celebrated history of, you know, putting the people least ready for interactions with other human beings as the lead. We should note that in Detroiters, Tim is married to Sam's sister. So right. We'd have to stipulate that they broke up or sure. She died or something. So mm-hmm. Let's say he's a divorcee. Mm-hmm. So Tim would be the like weird but sweet divorcee, sort of like Jason Mesnick. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, I don't see him getting engaged at the end of this. too mm-hmm. soon after his divorce, for one sure. thing. And he doesn't want to move to L.A. You know, he doesn't want right. to be an influencer. His life is being an ad man at Cramblin Duvet in Detroit. So mm-hmm. that's where he's going to end up. So I think that's how we're going to go, which means that Sam would be cast on The Bachelorette. But because he's a kind, funny doofus, he will not win. He'll be politely ignored / humored by the lead. Mm-hmm. But he'll manage to stay on for a while by talking shit about the other guys and being the Bachelorette's eyes and ears in the house.
Right.
Your classic tattletale. Mm-hmm. Every season needs one. And that would be him. And honestly, it's not a bad strategy if you're not going to win and you want to stay on for a while.
Right.
So I think he would end up being beloved by the other men, mm-hmm. which means he'd stand a good chance of being cast on Bachelor in Paradise, where yep. he'd have a whirlwind romance with like a 22-year-old influencer from Denver.
Right.
Which will ultimately end acrimoniously. And he'll end up back in Detroit at Cramblin Duvet, which is where he's meant to be.
I have a quick follow-up. Does Sam get far enough for hometown dates? And if so, and his dates...
No.
Okay.
No. Well, maybe. You know, I kind of see him as like a Rodney. I don't know if you guys watched Michelle's season. Rodney was this really sweet, like nice guy who in any other context would be considered very handsome. But right. on The Bachelorette, you know, those people are like freaks of nature. So he looked like sort of just average. But mm-hmm. I think in real life, we'd be like, wow, he's hot.
Right.
He somehow made it to hometowns. But then didn't win. So maybe Sam could pull that. But I'm seeing him more as like a tattletale right. Who like ekes through maybe the first 4 or 5 weeks.
Fantastic. We're here with Will Hines. Will, here is our question for you. We want you to take any Tim Robinson character from I Think You Should Leave and insert him into the next season of any Marvel show on Disney Plus. How does the Tim Robinson character fuck it up, or does he unexpectedly thrive?
I want the Tim Robinson character who wants the waiter to help manipulate his girlfriend into not eating all of the chips with toppings on them. I want him to come back in the next season of Moon Knight.
Yes.
Because I want Stephen Grant, the nervous persona of the Moon Knight, to have a hallucination about the asylum, and I want that Tim Robinson character to be running the asylum and to be the character that Stephen Grant has to go to for advice throughout the season. Uh-huh. But he's always lying. He's yeah. always scamming. He's always sweaty, obviously lying mm-hmm. and not helping. So you always have to kind of thwart him to explore the asylum to find out help elsewhere.
Right. He's also stalling a lot because every time the Tim Robinson or every time Stephen asks him something, he just goes, "What?
Yes.
What?
What? That's,
what?
No, that's quite, no, no, I'm not an Egyptian god. What? No, you're not dead. No, why would you be dead? This is a real asylum. It's real." So, and I want like 20 to 30 minutes of that in every episode.
We're here with Will Leach. Will, here is your thought experiment. We know from your last Around the Dial segment that you're a fan of Adam Scott's Severance, and from a past canon pitch that you are a fan of Adam Scott's Party Down. If you had to trade careers with one of them, would it be Severance's Mark or Party Down's Henry, and why?
I would trade with Party Down's Henry.
Okay.
Because one core thing about Henry is he's actually a really talented actor. Mm-hmm. And to me, that was always one of the best parts about that show was that, like, he sure is struggling and has quit the business. But as we discover in the great Steve Guttenberg episode, which was the one that I put up for the canon,
yep.
she finds his old DVD and he's actually really, really good. And I always like that idea. I'm always fond of things that are about people who are talented and still fail. Mm-hmm. And so the idea of, I don't have anything that like people would like find an old DVD of me doing and be like, wow, he's so talented. So I would take that knowing that I was good and yet I still failed would make me realize it was actually something personal within me that had done it. And that would resolve an answer to a question that I currently don't have an answer to.
What about the Mr. Show episode where you're in the crowd? You're talking a big game about that just on the show.
I'm just saying, it's true. If you do find out, you're like, wow, the back of that guy's head and his white, somewhat silk shirt and the way that he bounces when he chuckles. There's a future star.
That man isn't in the crowd.
He is the crowd.
Marriott Bonvoy is the official hotel partner of US Soccer. Join Marriott Bonvoy today to get closer to the game with exclusive perks, unforgettable experiences, and benefits that go beyond the pitch. SpringHill Suites, part of Marriott Bonvoy, offers complimentary hot breakfast and spacious all-suite accommodations, perfect for the whole team, with room for up to 6 guests. Make your next getaway a win. Learn more at springhillsuites.marriott.com.